Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
Evin prison in Tehran is a symbol of Iran's repressive rule. But when Israel bombed its front gate, critics of the Iranian government said they still felt stuck.
Between a regime that takes innocent people and throws them in prison, and so-called liberators who want to free them by bombing them and killing them.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Congo and Rwanda have signed a U.S.-brokered peace deal, but will it actually lead to peace?
I am extremely concerned that there will be handshakes and photographs and smiles, and that very little will change.
And when he packed for a 10-year journey to every country on Earth, Thor Pedersen brought rope, a knife, and a compass.
I haven't used a compass for a single thing.
He did, though, have plenty of adventures. That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. It has been nearly a week since the U.S. dropped bombs on Iranian nuclear sites. There are still lots of unanswered questions about exactly what those bombs destroyed and what they did not. President Trump and his defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, say that three Iranian nuclear sites were, quote, obliterated. An early U.S. intelligence assessment suggests that the facilities were damaged, not totally destroyed. Numerous other targets in Iran were hit by American and Israeli warplanes over 12 days of bombing. One of them was the infamous Evin prison in Tehran. It is known for holding human rights activists, protesters, and political dissidents, The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Iran's state TV showed the aftermath of Monday's blast. A reporter walks through the destruction. This used to be the visitor center, he says, where families come to see their loved ones. In another scene, he takes viewers to the clinic of the prison. There's shattered glass everywhere, walls have crumbled, boxes of medicine scattered on the floor. Shortly after Monday's attack, Israel's foreign minister Gideon Saar posted on X that this was his country's response to Iran targeting civilians in Israel. Defense Minister Israel Katz said the goal was to destroy Iran's, quote, internal repression facilities. Families of the prisoners and staff gathered at the site in search of news. Mohammad Reza Valizadeh, whose brother is in Evin prison, says he got a call from him describing the chaos. The force of the blast was so massive, he says, that several buildings within the prison compound have been damaged. Some buildings were on fire. He says the prisoners were terrified, but luckily at the time of the attack, many were outside in the courtyard. That's how they survived. The Iranian government hasn't made public the exact death toll, but immediately after the attack, officials put the prisoners on buses and moved them to different facilities. Saya Saidal, a PhD student, is serving a 2-year sentence in Evin for spreading falsehoods on social media. In an audio recording posted on her Instagram account, she says, "If the bombings by Israel didn't kill us, the conditions inside this prison will." Her Instagram account is run by someone else while she serves her time.
When the bombs dropped, it made me very emotional.
Siamak Namazi spent 8 years in Evin prison. He's an Iranian-American businessman. In 2015, he went back to Iran to attend the funeral. On the way back, he was stopped and taken away. Iran often takes dual citizens hostage to use as leverage in negotiations with other countries. That was the case with Namazi.
I was there through three presidencies, right? They took me during Obama's time, and then through Trump one, and a good portion of the Biden administration until there was finally a deal.
Namazi was released in 2023 as part of a prisoner exchange with the U.S. He now lives in the States. This week, when he saw the images of the bombed prison, he says he was in tears.
I've seen the images. I was looking at, oh my God, that was, you know, the physiotherapy room. That's where I used to go when I hurt myself. And wow, I could have been lying in that bed.
The thing with a place like Evin Prison, Namazi says, is that you can find some of the best and the worst people there. For example, he recalls a particularly cruel judge he had nicknamed Criminal.
I learned yesterday that he's among the dead. Definitely didn't shed a tear for that one.
But he says the prison is mostly run by staff who are not cruel. There are those he will never forget.
In some of the hardest times, just a kind secretary when no one was hearing saying, you know, don't worry, don't listen to what these guys are saying. Everyone outside knows that you're innocent. Just these small acts of kindness.
The United Nations human rights spokesperson, Thamin Al-Khitan, said on Tuesday that Evin Prison was not a military target. Striking it, he added, is a grave breach of international humanitarian law. Namazi also doesn't see how this could advance the cause of those who oppose the government in Iran, as Israel claims the goal to be.
When you talk about symbol of blowing open that gate and telling the people, you know, the door is open, all you got to do is walk out of it, that's not quite true.
Names of some of those who died are starting to come out. Ali Fard, a 20-something, who was serving his mandatory military service as a guard at the prison. Mehrangiz Imenpour, a painter who happened to be passing by. Zahra Ebadi, a social worker who had to take her 5-year-old son to work that day because the daycare was closed. Former hostage Sia Maknamazi says the events of the past 2 weeks show that Iranians are stuck.
Between a regime that takes innocent people and throws them in prison, and so-called liberators who want to free them by bombing them and killing them.
He's in touch with his former cellmates and activists in Iran who compare the Iranian government after this war to a wounded bear. Israel was successful in recruiting informants who helped it carry out its attacks.
The big fear is that this wounded bear, in order to consolidate its power, is going to start a reign of terror.
There are already reports of that. State media said this week that some 700 people have been arrested for having connections with Western and Israeli intelligence networks. On Wednesday, Iran also executed 3 people who it said had helped smuggle in equipment used in the assassination of an official. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Over the last several months, international students at U.S. campuses have found themselves caught up in political havoc. The Trump administration has announced enhanced scrutiny of student visa applications, and specifically for Harvard University has moved to block admittance for all international students. Some colleges abroad are now stepping in to help. Kirk Carapeza covers higher education for GBH Boston. Kirk, hello.
Hey, good to be here.
So how are colleges outside of the U.S. now trying to step in here?
Yeah, so the University of Toronto and the Harvard Kennedy School of Government announced a backup plan this week. If visa restrictions block students from returning to the U.S. this fall, some of their grad students could continue their studies north of the border in Canada. And students could take government courses in Toronto that are co-taught by faculty from both schools.
And the University of Toronto is not the only school to be stepping in to help here, right?
No, other schools have also opened their doors, offering spots to U.S.-bound students this fall. American University of Nigeria and Al-Akhawain University in Morocco. At Franklin University in Switzerland, there are 40 seats this fall for students from colleges in the U.S., and that school is even offering scholarships now. Marjorie Haas is president of the Council of Independent Colleges here in the U.S., and she says more schools are looking abroad for help to survive what she calls Trump's chaos tax.
Institutions are having to take not just their financial resources, but their time, their energy to plan for chaos of the country's own making.
And Haas tells me just knowing that some schools have international partners ready to jump in, even, you know, on a student-by-student basis at the last minute, it's a huge relief.
So, Kirk, can you give me an update on the two things that I mentioned in the introduction, the enhanced scrutiny of student visa applications and threats against Harvard specifically? Where do those both stand?
Sure. So just to review, the Department of Homeland Security says Harvard specifically shouldn't be allowed to enroll any international students because some of them participated in Gaza-related protests that some on the right have characterized as either anti-American or anti-Semitic. And the government has said that enrolling international students is a privilege, not a right. Harvard has sued the government, and for now, a federal judge in Boston has blocked the move. But the fallout is already here. I mean, if you look at Harvard Kennedy School, they're already laying off staff. Last year, more than half of the students there came from abroad. And in a message to faculty this week, the dean blamed, quote, unprecedented headwinds, including threats to international students and deep federal research cuts. Colleges are drawing up many different budget plans, ranging from, you know, it's going to be business as usual to what if zero students come back in the fall?
International students.
International students, right.
So those schools that aren't Harvard, they are probably preparing for whatever happens with student visas.
Right.
Application interviews were put on hold for a little while. Now there's enhanced scrutiny for those applications. What's the latest
right.
with that?
Yeah, so the interviews are back on, but they're increasing scrutiny of students' social media accounts. You know, it's easy to get sucked into Harvard because it grabs so many headlines. But if you just look at, you know, Worcester here in Massachusetts, there's a school, Clark University, where two-thirds of their graduate students are from abroad, and they're planning to cut a third of their faculty over the next few years because they're so afraid of enrollment dropping.
So that's how some of the schools are reacting. What do supporters of this plan make of the Trump administration's actions?
Yeah, they say that, you know, the schools are overreacting and that this scrutiny is long overdue. They point to similar changes and updates that went into effect after 9/11. And, you know, they say this all might slow things down for a while. But in the end, you know, there will be some rejections for students who in the past might have gotten in. I spoke with Simon Hankinson. He's a senior researcher at the Heritage Foundation. And he says these changes shouldn't make a huge difference unless a school is overwhelmingly reliant on foreign students.
I don't understand why some American colleges have over 50% foreign students, other than it's just a cash cow that's getting them a lot of money, and they don't want to cut off the supply of cash.
And Hankinson says schools are cherry-picking sad visa stories to win back public support.
They're going to find the cases that involve the puppies and the children and the grandmas and the ones that make you go, hey, that's weird.
All right. So what else are American colleges doing to help students? Maybe behind the scenes as there's all this uncertainty?
Right. Yeah. They're quietly hosting international students who chose not to leave this summer just to avoid any visa issues.
Oh.
One small college in the Midwest is putting up more than 100 students who otherwise would have gone home for the summer. About half of their incoming international class has their visas, but others are still in limbo. Some are getting interviews, some are not.
Kirk Carapeza covers higher education for GBH in Boston. Thank you so much, Kirk.
Thank you, Carolyn.
We want to spend a moment now remembering the Argentine-American pianist, conductor, and composer Lalo Schifrin. He died yesterday at the age of 93. Now, you may not have heard of him, but you almost certainly have heard one of his compositions. The Mission Impossible theme song. It has been spoofed many times since the original show aired in the 1960s, and it is probably what would come to mind if I asked you what spy music sounds like. Schifrin's career as a television and film score composer spanned seven decades. He contributed to classics like Cool Hand Luke, Dirty Harry, and the Amityville Horror. Lalo Schifrin was also a prolific composer of contemporary classical music not made for the big or small screens. This piece is from his jazz piano sonata for solo piano, performed here by fellow Argentine pianist Marion Conti. This, though, was not Schifrin's forte. He was known for a much bigger sound, infusing Latin American rhythms into his arrangements for large orchestras. He He also collaborated with the American jazz legend Dizzy Gillespie, serving as composer, arranger, and pianist on several of Gillespie's albums in the early 1960s. Here is the title track from the last album they worked on together, Free Ride, released in 1977. And coming up, the story behind an NBA draft pick that took everyone, including the player, by surprise. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor here at The World. While I may not be a familiar voice, I've been deeply committed to our work here at The World for years, helping to share the exceptional global journalism you know and love. Since our launch in 1996, the world has weathered many storms, and we remain committed to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. But we are in unprecedented times, and never has the threat to public media been greater than right now because of the efforts to withdraw all federal funding. This puts greater pressure on our newsroom and our journalists. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We're powered by listeners like you. And right now, we need your help. Even if you've never given before, perhaps today is the day. We are in our spring fundraising drive, and a generous donor has offered a 2-to-1 match, tripling your impact between now and June 30th. That means, if you donate $25, we receive $75. Your $100 equals to another $300. If you've given in the past, please consider renewing your gift or increasing your monthly contribution, if only by a small amount. Every gift, no matter how small, truly makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Fast fashion means it's cheaper and easier than ever to buy lots of clothes. It also means more clothes getting tossed or donated. There's only so much room in secondhand shops, so some end up as trash, including in piles in Chile's Atacama Desert. To address the problem, Chile's government has taken a first step toward holding companies that import the clothing responsible for the waste. Barbara Pino is an expert on the geopolitics of fashion who splits her time between Chile and Italy. She told me Chile has become an unintentional dumping ground of the world's textile waste.
Every year, hundreds of tons of secondhand and unsold garments are arriving. All our regulations are permitting this happens. This is legal. But what is illegal is that secondhand clothes that arrives to Chile that are not sold, people are throwing these bales into the desert.
So these are specifically secondhand clothing that ends up in Chile for resale, but when it can't be resold, it gets dumped.
Yes, but it's also because the clothes that are arriving are not all in the best quality. So it's like most of them are also garbage or textiles that are not useful anymore.
So that is the problem. Let's talk about the solution. How exactly is Chile trying to put more responsibility on clothing companies to deal with this problem?
Okay, what is happening in Chile is the government declared that textiles can be a dangerous garbage for the people. You know, like textiles are also full of microplastic and it's not easy to recycle or they are not biodegradable. Okay, so the people, the importers are going to be obliged to follow some rules that make the importer being responsible for what they are bringing from outside from Chile.
So the solution here is that textiles, clothing, is now going to be included into something called a producer responsibility law, which has existed for almost a decade in Chile, but it excluded textiles up until now.
Yeah.
What does including textiles in this producer responsibility law mean? What does that require producers to do?
Oh, fantastic question, because really I don't know, because now we have to build that. Okay, so it's we are really, really in the beginnings of this. So we need to build all that chain that are going to be responsible of this waste. Nothing of that is done.
So it all has to be built. I'm wondering, has a law like this been passed elsewhere that is specifically related to clothing or the textile industry? I'm wondering if there's hints about how this might be done.
Oh, yeah, in Europe. For example, now in Paris, in France, it was like a tax that it was imposed to fast fashion clothes. So they are going to be a little bit more expensive. So that money are going to be for the recycle or the whatever is going to happen after. And in this way, the people and also the manufacturers are not going to overproduce that quantity of clothes.
So if I go buy a shirt at H&M in Paris, you're saying I would pay a little bit extra, and then H&M would have to use that money to responsibly dispose of that shirt once I stop wearing it. So this approach is not unique to waste, as you've just said. I know that also I think Japan, in addition to Europe, have policies in place around this type of thing. Is this approach growing around the world, this approach of making companies responsible for the end disposal of products?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We can't think about the industry of fashion just focus in different territories. This is a supply chain, a global supply chain that work as a system of powers that somehow are putting up some places and putting down some others. For example, some places are the manufacturing of the world, like Bangladesh, like India and China. Some other ones are the creative ones, Global North. And then we have some other ones that are becoming the landfills of the fashion industry, for example, Ghana and Chile.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't see this problem like as unique. And I think that that is one of the most important challenge of this new responsibility law, because we can't see as an isolated problem what is happening in the desert. What is happening in the desert, it's a consequence of the global industry.
Barbara Pino is an expert on the geopolitics of fashion. It was widely expected. The first pick in this year's NBA draft went to the 18-year-old who grew up in Newport, Maine.
Cooper Flagg from Duke University.
He is going to the Dallas Mavericks, but the 16th pick? Now that one, total surprise, as the world's Bianca Hillier reports.
Let's back up just a little bit to the 15th pick.
Thomas Sorber from Georgetown University.
Once Thomas Sorber was selected and cameras captured his reaction, a young man named Yang Hansen noticed something curious happening. He later told the press that camera crews started moving, leaving the zone where the NBA draft prospects were sitting and coming over to his area, way up in the stands where the general public was sitting. At that point, he thought, is something big about to happen?
With the 16th pick in the 2025 NBA draft, the Memphis Grizzlies select Yang Hansen from Zibo, China, and the Qingdao Eagles.
Yang stood up and waved his arm in the air. He was among the many people surprised to hear his name. Yang said he expected to be selected at the end of the first round. NBA experts had him more so in the second round, if that. Either way, number 16 was a shock. But Yang has put in the work. The 7'1" center started his Chinese Basketball Association professional career in 2023. He was named the league's Rookie of the Year in his debut season and last year averaged nearly 17 points per game. On social media, his team, the Qingdao Eagles, say they're beyond proud and consider Yang an outstanding representative of the new generation of Chinese basketball. It has been almost a decade since a Chinese player was selected at the NBA draft, and less than 10 Chinese men have ever played in the league. By far the most famous among them is Yao Ming.
Here's Yao Ming with a fadeaway. He's tied the game with 0.8 seconds remaining.
Yao retired in 2011. Earlier this week, the Hall of Famer had some kind words to say about Yang before he was even drafted.
He's a very talented kid, very nice kid. I wish him all good luck, and he deserved the best with all the effort he put into his team.
Yang's new team was initially going to be the Memphis Grizzlies, but he's since been traded to the Portland Trail Blazers. That's where he'll be when the next season of the NBA tips off in October. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us. This afternoon, the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda signed a peace deal. It was brokered by the Trump administration and signed in Washington. If it succeeds, the agreement could help bring an end to a long and deadly conflict between the two countries. There are many caveats, however. Chief among them, the deal does not include the major insurgent group that currently occupies areas of eastern DRC. That group is called M23. Michelle Gavin is a senior fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and former U.S. ambassador to Botswana.
We know that the deal includes some general principles, like respect for each state's territorial integrity, provisions for the disarmament of non-state armed groups. But these are difficult to square with the realities of Eastern Congo, where it's not just M23. There are scores upon scores of different armed actors operating in the area, and there have been for a couple of decades now. So exactly how these groups are going to be disarmed, by whom, when that didn't happen over the course of a longstanding UN peacekeeping mission and multiple military interventions by African forces, it's a bit difficult to say.
And so this deal is between DRC and Rwanda and does not include any of those rebel groups that you just mentioned.
That is absolutely right.
We should note that many, many people suggest that Rwanda is backing M23. Rwanda denies that, but this would not be any sort of admission of involvement of Rwanda behind M23, correct?
That is correct. And the evidence is quite solid to suggest that Rwanda supports M23. And Rwanda also has its forces, formal Rwandan forces, in Congo. And in fact, just yesterday, the Rwandan foreign minister tweeted that the deal that was going to be signed would not include the precondition that the Rwandans withdraw from any of their positions. So this peace deal not only doesn't include M23, it doesn't require that formal Rwandan forces go back to the Rwandan side of the border.
Do you think the wording we're using, I think, is the word that wording that everyone's using, that the administration's using, peace deal? I mean, do you think that's fair?
No. No. I mean, Rwanda and Congo were not at war, right, in any kind of formal sense. So it was really this proxy force that's, yes, it's backed by Rwanda, but frankly, it's also backed by Uganda, and it's Congolese in origin. So it's not entirely a Rwandan creation. Its military advances have unquestionably been enabled by Rwandan support. So I just don't understand peace between who, right? If the M23 is not part of the deal and Rwandans don't have to get out of the territory, what is this?
So what will this deal do?
Great question. I think this deal eases pressure on both Kigali and Kinshasa because they can point to their cooperation in signing it. I think the U.S. theory must be that step by step, this could help build some kind of confidence between the parties, and that the parallel promise of U.S. investment in infrastructure and mineral processing in the region will begin to change the incentive structure, essentially, where there's a more lucrative possibility than continuing the war economy. That's the best case I can make for why this makes sense.
So what you're referring to here is that DRC offered the U.S. access to minerals in the country. What exactly does that mean for the U.S.?
Well, there's no question that DRC is rich in critical minerals that are required in a lot of the technology we use today, and certainly for a transition to a green economy. It's unclear exactly what is on offer. A lot of Congo's mines are already spoken for, and there's a tremendous amount of Chinese investment. A lot of the critical minerals that come out of Rwanda are not necessarily mined in Rwanda, so there have been questions about whether or not eventually this will legitimize Rwandan control over Congolese resources. It's all very unclear exactly how the economic element of this is intended to work.
And I should note that the mineral deal is officially separate from the peace agreement. Is that right?
That is right, yes.
The impacts you have outlined here sound to me like they are all concerning the leaders of these countries. Do you anticipate that this deal will change the situation on the ground at all for people living through war and the humanitarian impacts that it has caused?
I wish I anticipated that, but no, I am extremely concerned that there will be handshakes and photographs and smiles, and that very little will change for the people dealing with insecurity, living under the M23's administration, and watching a military buildup, which has been happening on both sides. So they're both preparing for fighting to break out again. So no, I don't think that there will be much to celebrate for the Congolese on the ground.
Michelle Gavin served as U.S. ambassador to Botswana. She's now a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, in Syria, tens of thousands of people alleged to have connections to ISIS have been detained for years in sprawling camps. The country's new government is now trying to send those detainees back to their home countries. Many of them are spouses or kids of fighters, not combatants themselves. Kazakhstan, in Central Asia, is one of the few countries that's agreed to repatriate its citizens and rehabilitate them. But as Levi Bridges reports, that program's success is now in jeopardy.
For decades under the Soviet Union, religion was suppressed in Central Asia. Soviet authorities even destroyed mosques. But three decades later, Islam is rapidly growing in countries like Kazakhstan. Just recently, I was sitting inside a mosque in the Kazakh city of Aktau, where I overheard a woman talking about studying Arabic. She says she wants to go to Egypt or maybe Cyprus. Lots of Kazakhs travel to Arab countries to connect with Islamic culture. I talked to one Kazakh woman over Zoom who moved to Egypt a decade ago with her husband. He wanted to study religion in a country where Islam plays a greater role in society. In Egypt, they started a family, four kids. There, her husband embraced a hard-line version of Islam, and he brought the family to Syria, where he joined ISIS. She says, the war froze my heart. You only focus on keeping the kids safe or where to find some bread. You can't think about anything else. Her husband died in the conflict, and she wound up at that huge camp in Syria for detained ISIS members. Many have languished there for years, but in 2019, Kazakhstan repatriated more than 700 of its citizens from Syria, most of them women and kids. The returnees were sent to Aktau on the Caspian Sea and were held at an old Soviet summer camp where they received psychological help. Theologians studied the Quran with them, teaching a more moderate faith. We understood that it's not Islam. She says, in Syria, we were taught to be aggressive and intolerant. It was ideology, not Islam. The returnees weren't taught to scorn religion. Islamic elements were integrated into the rehabilitation program. Gulnaz Razdikova is a Kazakh psychologist who worked with the families. Rehabilitation had to take place within their religious worldview, Razdikova says. That's what made the process truly healing. The women eventually returned back to their home communities in Kazakhstan, where they received ongoing psychological support and job training. Eric Rudenschold is the former National Security Council Director for Central Asia and helped direct U.S. support to Kazakhstan's repatriation program. He says some of the women were shunned by their communities.
In almost every case, the local people who are meeting these repatriates have fears and concerns because on state media and everything else, they've been labeled terrorists, jihadists for years.
Programs were implemented to turn down the suspicion in these communities. Rudenschold says Kazakhstan and other countries who have repatriated their citizens from Syria should be applauded.
They are kind of model countries for everybody else to sort of look at and go, well, maybe rehabilitation can be done.
Kazakhs also say the program is a success. I talked to another Kazakh woman whose grandchildren were repatriated from Syria. She says, at first, my grandchildren were terrified by big crowds. They'd witnessed bombings in Syria. But now they're well-adjusted, succeeding in school and playing sports. But many children face ongoing challenges. Stephen Wine is a psychiatry professor at the University of Illinois College of Medicine who helped rehabilitate former ISIS members and their families in Kazakhstan.
We're worried about kids acting out or drug use or getting involved in crime and, in the very worst case, involved in extremist or violent activities. And that's why we can't completely say that the program is a success and move on.
For years, the U.S. government provided funding and other assistance to train Kazakh professionals to better support these at-risk youth, one of the goals being to stop them from becoming terrorists when they grow up. But most of that funding has been doged. That worries people like Wine.
So a couple of bucks may have been saved, but pulling out, in my opinion, is not the right thing to do, and it's dangerous.
The U.S. has also cut funding for monitoring terrorist recruitment in Central Asia. Noah Tucker used to research extremism in the region for USAID. He says right now, officials are asking him how events in Syria are affecting recruitment to extremist organizations.
And I have to tell them that we just don't know because we don't have support to continue to explore these things.
Kazakh officials told me rehabilitation only works with long-term support. But even without international engagement, Central Asian regional and religious leaders are still trying to stop the threat. Back at the mosque in Aktau, I overhear the woman who wants to study in an Arab state get a stern warning. A man tells her if she does go, to please be careful about falling into the hands of extremists. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges, Aktau, Kazakhstan.
On the Pacific island nation of Tuvalu, many residents are looking for a way out. More than a third of the population, out of about 10,000, has applied for a special climate change visa for Australia. Tuvalu is a string of low-lying coral atolls. Those are ring-shaped islands made of coral. Two of the nine atolls are already largely submerged by rising seas. The first-of-its-kind visa program will allow a group of Tuvaluans to become permanent residents of Australia. A total of 280 climate change visas will be awarded each year. Venice is in the global spotlight this week. The Italian city is playing host to the nuptials of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez, a journalist and an entrepreneur. Celebrity magazines and chat shows are covering it enthusiastically. Many Venetians themselves seem to be decidedly less than thrilled. Angelo von Scheich from our partners at Deutsche Welle, DW, asked people for thoughts and got an earful.
Venice is its usual self. Loaded with tourists and beautifully laid out in the summer sun. But something is boiling underneath the surface. As in almost every calle, posters with the words "No space for Bezos" have appeared. Many Venetians don't want Jeff Bezos taking over their city.
Non siamo contro il matrimonio in sé, ma siamo contro l'utilizzo che si fa di Venezia.
Bezos, we are not against the marriage itself, says Josué David, a member of the protest movement No Space for Bezos. But we are against the way Venice is being treated. A very wealthy man comes here and uses Venice like his personal amusement park, like some kind of king. He arrives in the lagoon with nine yachts, an ecosystem that is already under threat, and he blocks half the city. We are not protesting so much against him personally, but rather against the way he acts, and against the city administration that makes all of this possible. The Bezos wedding is a multi-day affair. with guests attending a variety of parties spread out around the city in the run-up to the actual tying of the knot. At the time of recording, the rumor is that the large closing celebration on Saturday has had to move location due to security fears raised by the authorities. Additionally, the US billionaire's large yacht Kourou is no longer expected to come to the city as originally planned. Even the smaller run-up events have been shrouded in mystery, as I found out a few days ago when I popped by the Scuola della Misericordia in the city center.
Bezos non glielo so dire. Adesso abbiamo, cos'è, domani c'è un matrimonio.
Giovanni, white linen shirt with rolled up sleeves and sunglasses, supervises the preparations for an event, but not a Bezos one, he says. He did read in the newspapers that the billionaire is due to use their location later in the week. But, he says, he wouldn't know anything about that. Whatever Giovanni may or may not have known as we spoke, a few days later the Italian authorities asked for a part of the festivities to be moved from the Scuola della Misericordia to the Arsenale, as that venue is easier to secure. The threat level, they made clear, had been raised by the US attack on Iran. Jeff Bezos, let's not forget, is not just one of the world's richest men, he's also a major Pentagon contractor through his two enterprises. Blue Origin recently awarded a contract for 7 rocket missions worth a combined total of $2.3 billion and Amazon Web Services, which provides cloud services to the Department of Defense. Is it Amman Hotel? Security warnings and angry locals are unlikely to deter Bezos' 200-plus guests, many of them expected to be A-list celebrities like Ivanka Trump, Oprah Winfrey and Leonardo DiCaprio. The luxurious 5-star hotels along the Canal Grande are all booked out. Only no one seems to know who is staying there.
Se ho capito bene, durante il matrimonio di Jeff Bezos, alcuni dei ospiti saranno qua, giusto?
Noi non abbiamo nessuna informazione riguardo.
No?
This friendly but very firm hostess says she doesn't have any information about Bezos' guests sleeping in their hotel. Probably she isn't allowed to reveal anything about that. From the silent discretion of hotel staff to the loud protests of the streets, the Bezos nuptials are a spectacle of contrasts. The main contrast, however, is the one that pits the international super-rich against the ordinary residents in Venice. In protesters' minds, it's clear which side the mayor, Luigi Brugnaro, has come down on.
Beneficiari di questo matrimonio sarà sicuramente il sindaco in primis perché
one of the people that benefit from the wedding is the mayor himself, says protester Josué David. One of the venues that host one of the parties is owned by him. Mayor Brugnaro, however, is very angry with the protesters.
Sappiate che a Venezia siamo in mano a una deriva assurda.
He calls them a disgrace for the city. According to him, the wedding is an opportunity for Venice, and he hopes Jeff Bezos will find the time to shake his hand. Venice mayor and the protesters disagree on everything, but they have one thing in common. They all hope this wedding will be over soon.
That was Angelo von Schaik with our partners at Deutsche Welle. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thor Petersen got quite the welcome home when he returned to Copenhagen back in 2023. He had been away on a long adventure, a very long one. Petersen spent 10 years traveling the globe, visiting every single country on the planet. When he set out from Denmark in 2013, he wanted to visit every country without taking a single flight. What unfolded was a continuous adventure covering 220,000 miles and 203 countries, using every other mode of transportation you can imagine. He has a new book out about his adventure called The Impossible Journey. The World's Carol Hills caught up with Petersen soon after he got home.
You know, most people who travel across as many time zones as you have, they typically feel some jet lag. But you didn't fly. You had a month-long return journey home on a cargo ship. How do you feel since you've been home?
I'm very, very happy to be home amongst friends and family and speaking my native tongue and being able to drink an ice-cold glass of Danish milk. But it's also really hectic. There's a lot of attention around this right now. I'm also trying to get back into society in Denmark. I mean, I've been gone for 10 years, so I need to go through registration and prove that I'm a Danish citizen and all that stuff.
It's just sort of amazing that you were gone for 10 years. So over the past decade, you took 37 container ships, 158 trains, 351 buses, 219 taxis, 33 boats, and 43 rickshaws. What other forms of transport did you use?
I think you covered it pretty well. So the idea was that it would mostly be public transportation. And that means that the trains and buses would be the primary form of transportation. Then going out to island nations, you need to find some sort of vessel. So if there was a ferry, I would buy a ticket and that would be the easiest way to go. But there are no ferries between the Pacific island nations, for instance. And so then you go to marinas or you go to fishermen's ports or you talk to people and you find your way through.
So you mentioned you wanted to use public transport as much as possible on this adventure. What was the longest you were able to travel just on public transport?
That would probably be 5 days. I was 5 days in a train going from Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia to Moscow in Russia.
What was the most unusual form of transport you took or the most kind of unusual experience you had out there?
That's another good question. That could be a number of any forms of transportation, to be honest. A truck that I sat on top of for 2 days in the Congo. Probably the truck.
Wow. Tell us about some of the most challenging logistical problems you faced on this journey.
Oh, boy. Well, leaving Tuvalu was quite a logistical challenge. I ended up being in Tuvalu for 2 months, and they have 4 government vessels, and all these vessels had different forms of issues, so they weren't quite seaworthy at the time when I was there. So it just kept getting delayed and delayed, delayed. And there are airplanes, so you could fly out, but that wasn't an option for me. So it was kind of a question about how are you going to get away from this Pacific Island nation? And it did take me 2 months to work it out.
Did you ever feel in danger or under threat at all in this 10-year-long journey?
Yes, I did. It's not very representative of the journey, but this has been over the span of nearly a decade in every country in the world and a distance that is equivalent to going from Earth to the moon. So it would be unlikely if nothing went wrong at any point. Things that I usually list would be being on board a container ship in the North Atlantic in the wintertime in a severe storm with 20-foot swell and ice in the water and not far from where Titanic went down. So that was nerve-wracking. I've been at gunpoint a few times. 3 of the vessels I've traveled on board are confirmed to be at the bottom of the sea today. Wow. I had cerebral malaria at one point. That's the kind of malaria that goes to your brain that can end your life within a couple of days if it goes untreated. But in the big picture, it was quite safe.
Wow. Were you alone on this long, long journey? Were you ever traveling with people or were you just on your own the whole time?
I didn't have a travel companion along the way, although my wife did come out to visit me 27 times.
It's so interesting when I read about you, your wife was your girlfriend when this trip started, and then you got married in the middle of it. How did that work?
Yeah, we got married twice. So we care dearly about each other, and we cared so much about each other that we didn't want to split up. Then the pandemic broke out, and I got stuck in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong was tight as a drum, so she couldn't get inside Hong Kong being my fiancé. But if we were married, then I could seek a special visa for her. So what we found out was that there's an agency in Utah that weds people online. And we went down that route. It's very much a long story, but the short version is that she got married on December 19th and I got married on December 20th due to the time difference. And we got the paperwork and I pushed it through in Hong Kong and eventually she could fly into Hong Kong. A few years later, when I finally left Hong Kong and I was well into the Pacific, she came to see me again in Vanuatu. And we saw our chance to get married. There was a German woman who ran, she ran a resort there, and she was very helpful. And we got married. We're still not officially married in Denmark, but what we do know is we're married in Utah, in Hong Kong, and in Vanuatu.
Incredible story. Now that you've been to every country on Earth, are there any you want to go back to and spend more time in?
Yes, all of them. All of them. I really feel that every country in the world has something to offer and there's something interesting. And in my case, I seem to have friends in almost every country around the world. Also because of the size of this project, I don't feel that I had enough time to explore most countries, certainly not the big countries. So there are a great deal of countries I'd like to go back to.
So you covered more than 220,000 miles in your travels. Any particular country where you really enjoyed the music? And give us a little hint on when it was.
Yeah, actually, when I was traveling through Nigeria, I discovered a Nigerian band called P-Square. And there was a hit song back then, we're talking 2015, 2016, which was called Kolabo, which is sort of a pidgin for saying collaboration, Kolabo.
It's great to hear about new kinds of music to listen to. Now, my final question, Thor, any trips planned in the near future?
Yeah, actually there is. I'm one of those lucky people who has two countries, sort of have one passport though. But my father is from Denmark and my mother is from Finland and they split ways years ago. So my mother's back in Finland and it won't be long before I head up there and see how she lives and how she's doing.
That was the world's Carol Hills talking with Thor Petersen about his 10-year journey across the globe. Petersen's new book is called The Impossible Journey. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Look for us online at theworld.org and on YouTube. You can find our channel at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend, and we will see you back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Henry Becton, Richard Gingras, Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Rima Heider and Camilo Villa, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.